Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, in this episode, I'm going to be tackling a chicken and the egg question. And this chicken and the egg question idea comes from listener Firas Halawani, and I'm just going to jump right into it and see what his question is without a long preamble. So here's what he asks. Hey Scott, I've enjoyed your series on Ottoman lives. And that was a series I did on different people in the Ottoman Empire, like the Sultan, the Janissary, the eunuch, etc. I'm researching on why the Ottomans didn't adopt the printing press when it was invented. Any insights or references or similar findings is appreciated. Thank you. All right, Firas, that is your chicken and the egg question. And he didn't ask it in that way, but here's what I'm getting at. How does technology affect society? Does technology determine human action, or does human action determine technology? In the former, that technology determines human action, some people might think that there's really only one pathway that technology can work. For example, with an airplane, the way that physics is set up, there's not that many ways that you can design an airplane. You have to have wings that create drag that cause lift. You can't have kooky inventions like they had in the early 1900s or late 1800s where people had flapping bat wings like you see in the old-timey footage, black and white footage of people having these silly little contraptions and flying machines. Those just don't work according to the laws of physics. There's really only about one way an airplane can work. So for that reason, any society, they could have arrived at the airplane independently, but it's going to look a certain way, and people will see the practical advantages of flight, and society will follow along, and society will be changed by flight. You see airports crop up. You see the way that people conceive of distance differently. That's a case where technology really leads things, and technology affects human society. There's another perspective where society affects how they receive technology. This is putting the cart and the horse in different places. They would say that whether or not a technology is considered useful depends on what society that technology is being presented to. Some people might think flight is useful. A tribe in the Amazon might think, why on earth would we need this? This doesn't help me hunt animals more effectively. It doesn't help me survive being killed by a boa constrictor or a piranha. So who cares about this? Now, this question, this chicken and the egg, this might seem kind of esoteric, but I came across this question pretty early in my graduate studies. Early in my graduate program, I wrote a 50-page paper on clocks in the Ottoman Empire. And if you think that's completely ridiculous and why on earth would anyone do that? Well, if you've been with me this long in this podcasting journey, you probably understand why this is a good question. And if you think it's stupid, you probably quit this podcast a long time ago. So that's how I'm self-selective. I face the same question where historians had different ideas about clocks, and they were looking at the introduction of clocks in the 1300s, 1400s, 1500s in Europe. And the question was this: why were all these clock towers being built in public squares in European towns and cities when, until the invention of the pendulum in the 1500s, clocks really weren't all that accurate? They would have to be readjusted constantly, and you would have to use an accurate timekeeping device, like a water clock or a sundial, basically, to make sure your clock was accurate. But if you have a timekeeping device that really can't keep time on its own, why on earth did people build it? Now, people and historians have different theories. Some would say that with the emergence of mercantilism and guilds in the late Middle Ages, you had to find a way to quantify your time because now you were charging people for your billable hours. So when you go into town, you need to be able to point to a timekeeping device and show that, well, I worked for 2 hours, I need to be paid this amount. They would say that necessity is the mother of invention. There was a need for quantifiable time, so that's why clocks came about. Even though they weren't all that accurate, there was a social need for it. So later on, they did become more accurate, but that was a reason. Others would say that the technology showed up and then society just sort of built up around it. Timekeeping devices were more of an artistic curiosity, and they were flashy displays in a town square, and even if they weren't all that accurate, there wasn't that much of a social need for accurate timekeeping, but It was an ornate, beautiful device to have in a town square, kind of like a glockenspiel or a cuckoo clock, something nice to have. But as he started to pop up and appear, then there was a whole cottage industry of craftsmen that built up around timekeeping devices, and then they became more accurate over time. So there are different approaches to this, and one theory that I was exposed to in my graduate study was called the social construction of technological systems, and this is based on a 1987 edited volume by Thomas Hughes, Trevor Pinch, and Wiebe Beeker. And this is what the theory says, that technology doesn't determine human action, but human action shapes technology. They would say that the ways a technology is used can't be understood without understanding how that technology is embedded in its social context. So this theory, called the Scott theory, the social construction of technology theory, they hold that to understand the reasons that a society accepts or rejects technology should look to their social world. You can't just explain a technology's success by saying it's the best technology, but researchers have to look at the criteria of how the best is defined in a society and what groups and stakeholders participate in defining it. So they ask, who defines a technical criteria and why technical criteria are defined this way, and who is included or excluded? So one example, when I looked at clocks in the Ottoman Empire, I saw that timekeeping devices spread all over Europe by the 15th, 16th centuries. You had clocks in town squares. You had astronomical clocks that could follow the phases of the moon and planetary motion. But in the Ottoman Empire, you didn't have clocks in the same way. They were gifted to the Sultan by European ambassadors. And then you start seeing clocks appear in the 1700s and 1800s when Ottoman citizens are interested in European goods and clocks are seen as being French, so they might buy a grandfather clock or they might buy a pocket watch. But the need for timekeeping wasn't really there. There really wasn't a huge need for timekeeping until the 19th century when you have postal systems and steamships that have to follow a certain timetable down to the hour. And even up into the 20th century, Ottoman clocks were different. They would follow a system where during daylight, there was 12 hours, regardless of whether it was summer or winter. So some clocks in Ottoman households had to be reset every single day so that sunrise was 12 o'clock, then sunset was 12 o'clock, and hours would bend and flex because it was considered better that clocks would follow environmental conditions and not 24 hours, regardless of what your actual sunlight conditions were. So this is an example of how the uses of timekeeping was just considered in a different way in an Ottoman context. It wasn't as if suddenly mechanical clocks appear and everyone's conception of time changes. And mechanical clocks were introduced, but they were used in very different ways in the Ottoman Empire than in Europe. For example, Sultan Abdulhamit, who ruled in the late 1800s, received a special pocket watch from a German clockmaker who lived in Constantinople. And this was a mechanical clock that could tell Sultan Abdulhamit the times to pray, according to Islamic tradition, every day. Now, that's a hard thing to do with a mechanical clock because a Muslim prays five times a day, but the times at which he prays differ according to the position of the sun in the sky. So this mechanical clock could tell him different times of the day throughout the year when to pray. So this is a very sophisticated system, and it's much more complicated than your regular clock. But this is something that was considered more advantageous socially than something that would be in Europe. Now, I said at the top of this episode I wouldn't do a long preamble, but I guess I did. So the reason I went to that long preamble was to show you what I'm talking about here with Firas's question about the Ottoman Empire and why there weren't printing presses the same way there were in Europe. And this is a question that researchers have asked for a long time. The Gutenberg printing press explodes across Europe, but it's really not that popular in the Ottoman Empire until the 19th century. It lags by several centuries. Why is that? Is technology seen as being un-Islamic? To some people, yes, it was. But what do we mean by technology? And do they mean all technology? Well, for a lot of things, the Ottomans could be ahead of the curve, according to Europeans. And a lot of technology, like guns or cannons or ships, were readily adopted by the Ottomans. They had no problem with it. So what happened with the printing press? Why doesn't it show up till much later? That's what we're going to be tackling in this episode. And because I study the Ottoman Empire in my background, I like to compare it to Europe because there's so many similarities and so many differences, it makes for a good A-B testing case study. I've done this with the history of prostitution, with the history of copyright law, the history of slavery, and all sorts of other things. So let's start off first with the printing press and how it spread through Europe, and then we're going to look at theories on why it didn't spread in the Middle East. And then we're going to look at what sultans themselves actually said, what religious figures actually said, how the printing press comes to the Ottoman Empire, and what people thought of it then. And I hope that you come away from this episode, not just with some random facts about the printing press, but really the bigger question of how does society deal with technology? And this is an ever-pressing issue in the 21st century with smartphones. Just because we have a smartphone, do we blindly do what our technology tells us to do and we become addicted to it without thinking of it? Or we become addicted to it without thinking of the consequences? Do we try to have mastery over it and decide the terms in which we'll engage our technology? These are pressing questions in the 21st century, but they're not new questions. This is something that societies have dealt with since human civilization has existed. So let's jump right into it. The printing press was invented in the 15th century by Johannes Gutenberg in Germany in 1439. It took 400 years, but this printing technology spread to all regions of the world, displacing the manuscript or writing by hand and block printing. Printing presses were set up in Central and Western Europe. Major town functions as centers of diffusion. Printing presses come to Cologne in 1466, Rome in 1467, Venice in 1469, Paris in 1470, Krakow in 1473, London in 1477, and by 1481, there were 21 print shops in the Netherlands, and Italy and Germany had print shops in 40 towns. By 1500, there were about 1,000 printing presses in operation throughout Western Europe. They produced 8 million books. In the 1550s, there were 300 or more printers and booksellers in Geneva alone. The output was on the order of about 20 million volumes. In the 16th century, this rose tenfold to between 150 and 200 million volumes. And you can hear more about this in the episode I did on copyright law, where with the explosion of printing presses, now you have legal questions about copying someone else's works and plagiarism and other things. But there were few printing presses in the Ottoman Empire until the 1800s. They arrived intermittently here and there, especially among minority populations in the Ottoman Empire, and I'll talk more about those later. So you see one here in the 1500s. You see a tinkerer experimenting with books printed in Turkish in the 1700s, but they're not really set up throughout the empire until the 1800s. Why is that? One theory by the Ottoman historian Soraya Faruqi is the lack of interest, and religious reasons were among the reasons for their slow adoption. So the printing in Arabic, or in the Arabic script, which you see in the Turkish language and the Persian language and other languages, it encountered opposition by Muslim legal scholars and manuscript scribes. For that reason, printing presses were prohibited in the Ottoman Empire between 1483 and 1729 on penalty of death. I'm not saying this is true or not. I'm just talking about ideas put forward. While there was some Arabic type printing done, but this was done in Europe or in Christian parts of the Middle East for distribution among Middle Eastern Christians who spoke Arabic. And the oldest Quran printed with movable type was done in Venice in 1537 for the Ottoman market. First, let me give an overview of what was happening in the Ottoman Empire. And a lot of this information comes from an article by Ekrem Ekinci in Daily Sabah. So the Ottomans weren't ignorant about printing. They knew about it long before there was a huge print system in their own empire. The traveler Evliya Çelebi, who wrote a long travel log in the 17th century, talked about printing presses that he saw in Vienna, and it was something familiar in his works. Like I said, the first book in Arabic was published in Italy in 1514. Books in Arabic and Farsi were also published in Venice, Rome, and Vienna by humanist scholars who were interested in Semitic culture. These were usually books that merchants and missionaries could make use of. So you also have the Counter-Reformation with Catholic missionaries going to the Middle East to try to convert Orthodox Christians there to Catholicism. There were printing houses in Istanbul in the 15th century at the early years of printing. But these books weren't printed in Turkish. They were managed by Greek, Armenian, and Jewish community members, and they printed books in their own languages. So the Ottoman Empire was ruled by a Turkish dynasty that spoke Turkish, but you have a lot of different ethnic groups and language groups in the Ottoman Empire. Dozens, really. And you also have a lot of Jews who live there as well. So it was networks of people who would travel throughout the Mediterranean for trade, like Armenians and Jews and others. And it makes sense that they would encounter printing presses, take it back to their homeland in the Ottoman Empire, and set up newspapers or books there. Well, not really newspapers, they don't come till much later, but you do see books in these languages. In 1493, there was a Jewish print house in Thessaloniki. Armenians learned the printing press business in Italy and opened a print house in Istanbul in 1567, followed by the first Greek printing house in 1627. And the Sultan and the Ottoman leadership had no problem with this. The first thing that a Greek printing house printed was a booklet targeting the Jews. Sultan Murad III signed a firman, which is an official decree, in 1587, allowing the sale of books in Arabic, Farsi, and Turkish, which were published in Europe on Ottoman soil. So it doesn't seem like there's a problem with print shops in the beginning. So why didn't they spread in the Ottoman Empire? It seemed like Europe could very quickly understand the usefulness of these books. Well, the Turks didn't like books that were printed in printing houses, but they preferred handwritten books. Some thought that published books on printing presses lacked the art and grace of handwritten books. There was a whole infrastructure of calligraphy and those who did the art of calligraphy, and they thought that you couldn't reproduce the same thing. I mean, you have monks working in scriptoriums in the Middle Ages who do the same thing as well. But in the Ottoman Empire, it was on a whole other level. There were far more people involved in the production of handwritten books. And Ottoman intellectuals, who were also keen on aesthetics, enjoyed books written with elegant handwriting and whose ink shined, along with edges that were ornamented with golden gilt and covers that were made with care. There's all sorts of arguments why there are different aesthetic preferences in the Ottoman Empire versus Europe. Some think that the Islamic prohibition on depictions of Muhammad and perhaps a human form would make art stress more calligraphy, and that's why you see a lot more of these geometric patterns in mosques and other things. Not everyone accepts that theory, but that's at least one idea why calligraphy is so elevated and done to such a high technical style in the Islamic world. So reading books was not only a necessity, but also a pleasure. And there were plenty of calligraphy artists who copied plenty of books rapidly. These people could be out of a job. And on top of that, those who are keen on books belong to a certain class. You could have some issue where there's already an industry built up around it. And if we get back to our social construction of technology theory, a society like that just wouldn't value book production as much as one that didn't have a calligraphy class built up. Sort of like in cities today where taxis can lobby local city councils to make sure that Uber or Lyft don't come there because they have a whole industry built up around keeping a new innovation out, that could be a similar fact in the Ottoman Empire. So it's not a religious problem, it's an economics problem, and it's a special interest group problem. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Now, the first printing press that we know of, which originated among Muslims, or at least the first well-known case, was established by Ibrahim Muteferri Kah in 1727 during a reform period in the Ottoman Empire called the Tulip Period, where you have industrialization. You have more commerce with Europe. And it's called the Tulip Period because a lot of tulips are planted across Istanbul. It was opened 36 years later than the first printing press in New York, so this gives you an idea of the lag time. The project was commissioned by Said Efendi, an official who was taken to the Ottoman embassy in Paris as a clerk. He admired the printing presses in Paris, so upon his return, he assigned Ibrahim Muteferri Kah to establish a printing press similar to the one in Paris. Ibrahim Muteferri Kah wrote in the introduction of this work that many Islamic works were lost in Spain and other formerly Islamic areas because there weren't enough calligraphy artists to copy the books free of error, so he talked about the benefits of the printing press. He said, "The duplication of important books is useful for all. It helps the content of the books to spread. The writings are legible and are not affected by water. Printing is a profitable art. Thousands of books can be printed. While a volume of a book is written by hand, while only one volume of a book can be written by hand. This allows books to be cheaper. An index is added in the beginning and the end of the book, and one can find what he is looking for easily. It would be easy to access books in rural areas. Building libraries will support madrasas, which are Islamic schools. Hence, the number of people who study science will increase. It serves for the spread of Islam. Books in Arabic and Persian, which were published by the Europeans, as they have understood their importance, are filled with mistakes. These mistakes can be prevented. Printing presses augments the honor of the state. So Ibrahim Mutafarika, as a tradesman, is very pro-printing. But what about the religious class of the Ottoman Empire? What did they have to say about this? Well, the Sheikhul Islam, the top legal scholar of the Ottoman Empire, Abdullah Rumi Efendi, said this. He was asked this question. If a person, who claims to be an expert on the art of printing, says that he can make a mold of all letters and words of the books that are about lexicon, logic, philosophy, astronomy, and such non-religious books, and copy them by printing those molds on paper, will Islam allow him to copy books in this way? Upon this question, the scholar gave this answer. He gave a fatwa, which is sort of like a Supreme Court ruling. It's something that's going to guide other legal scholars in the future. And his answer was, those who are familiar with the art of printing produce many books in a very short time by making molds of letters and words and printing them on paper. Thus, they produce cheaper books. As it is useful, Islam allows these people to do that. A few people who know about the subject of the book should revise the book first. It would be good if the book is printed after reviewing it. Okay, so it sounds like there's no religious problem with printing books. Sounds like there's the technical ability to do it in the 1700s. But printing still doesn't take off. And the Grand Vizier, the chief advisor of the Sultan, liked Ibrahim Mutafarika's project. He received a firman, or an order, from Sultan Ahmed III in December 1727, allowing the printing of non-religious books. The first printing press was opened in a mansion on a pier in Istanbul, and four scholars were hired as proofreaders. The first book printed in 1727 was a two-volume Arabic Turkish lexicon titled Vankulu. The first volume of the dictionary was over 600 pages long, while the second volume was over 700 pages long. 1,000 copies were then printed. Ibrahim Mutafarika then went on to print two maps and 21 volumes of books from the opening of the printing house until his death in 1745. And you still have a few copies of these books in places like the Istanbul University Public Library. Now, there's a story that calligraphy artists of the period placed their inkstands and pencils into coffins and walked to the palace of the Sultan to protest. So the writing of religious books was given to calligraphy artists alone following this incident. A European political figure, Baron de Tott, who was in Istanbul during this period, claims that the printing press was closed due to lack of interest. And this is the story that's been repeated to this day. But it could have been economic factors as well that could have shut down the nascent printing industry. The printing house of Ibrahim Mutafarika was closed for a short span of time because of a war with Russia, but it was reopened as soon as possible. About 70% of the printed inventory of Ibrahim Mutafarika was sold, so there was interest in printed books. When he died in 1745, his son-in-law and assistant, Ibrahim Efendi, took over the printing presses. Following the Russo-Turkish War, two other men, Rashid and Vasif Efendi, bought the printing press as soon as they heard that the French embassy wanted to buy it at a very high price in order to prevent the printing press to fall into the hands of foreigners. They even printed a book in French. In time, the printing press became old and the letters of the printing blocks became useless. The printing house that Ibrahim Mutafarika founded was closed in 1798. After this, the state founded three different printing presses to publish official state documents. Later in the 1800s, Sultan Mahmud allowed religious books to be printed by printing presses. So that's the general overview of the story. Now, I will drill down a little bit more into the argument about whether printing presses should be adopted, but I want to mention just one thing here. Something that is left out in this whole discussion is the technological challenges of printing in different languages. The Latin alphabet is pretty easy from a technical standpoint to print in. You have 26 letters, lowercase, and then 26 more uppercase. You have some punctuation marks. It's pretty simple when it comes to movable type. But when you get into other languages, it becomes more challenging. The way that the Arabic alphabet goes, and it's kind of hard to crunch this down into a very short explanation, But in the Arabic alphabet, the way a letter looks changes depending on where it is in a word. If it's at the beginning of a word, it looks one way. If it's in the middle, it looks another way. If it's at the end, it looks a third way. So for every letter, you need at least three different forms. With all the letters in the Arabic alphabet, this is a lot of different ligatures and a lot of different pieces that you need on movable type. So it's a few times more difficult to print in the Arabic alphabet as it is in the Latin alphabet. Also, you need a sort of industrial infrastructure to go along your printing presses. You couldn't just drop a printing press into a jungle and start making newspapers. You need to have a total industrial system. With later technological changes that come to printing presses later in the 1700s, 1800s, it becomes much easier to print in the Arabic alphabet. But just the way that letters are constructed, it's easier in Latin than it is in Arabic. So that's one factor as well. If they were both absolutely the same, the Arabic and the Latin alphabets, or if the Turkish language used the Latin alphabet as it does today, I argue that the printing press would have come a lot earlier. So that's another point to keep in mind here, that the technological challenges are different. Now, I want to dig more into the argument that due to religious reasons, the printing press was banned in the Ottoman Empire in the Muslim world and only came about later. This claim comes from the French Franciscan priest, André Thevet, who lived from 1502 to 1590. Thevet wrote about statements and orders from the Sultan, called firmans, in the second volume of his eight-volume work entitled The True Portraits and Lives of Illustrious Greek, Latin, and Pagan Men. This was printed in Paris in 1584, and the book comprises chapters on distinguished historical figures. In Thevet's chapter on Johann Gutenberg, inventor of printing, he compared the invention and adoption of printing in Europe to the absence of the technology in the East. And this account comes from an article by Catherine Schwartz called Did Ottoman Sultans Ban Print? You can look at that article for more information about this. Anyway, here's what Thevet says. What I know for sure is that the Greeks, Armenians, Abyssinians, Turks, Persians, Moors, Arabs, and Tartars do not write their books except by hand. And that among the others, the Turks are constrained by the ordinance of their emperor, Bayazid II, published in the year 1483, carrying the prohibitions on the pain of death to not consume printed books, which was the ordinance confirmed by Selim, first of name, or Selim I, another sultan, his son, in the year 1515. So this French scholar is saying that the Ottomans banned the printing and the consumption of printed books on pain of death. But there's good reasons to think that Thevet is not a reliable witness. Other early modern European reports contradict his claim. Count Luigi Fernando Marsigli, who lived from 1658 to 1730, challenged the notion that the sultans banned printing. He had firsthand dealings with the Ottomans for 20 years from the 1680s onward. He traveled in the empire, battled against it in service to the Habsburgs, and lived among Ottoman Janissaries as a prisoner of war. In his book on the Ottoman military, he refuted the notion of the Ottoman printing ban. He said, "The Turks, it is true, do not print their books at all. But this is not, as is commonly believed, because they are prohibited to print or because their books are unworthy of printing." So his statement should carry weight because Marsigli was fluent in Ottoman Turkish. And he also amassed more than 600 manuscripts during his travels. Beyond that, Marsigli was himself a printer who worked with Medici Oriental typefaces at the press he established in Bologna. He said that the Turks never print their works, but this is not as is believed commonly because printing is banned or because their works are not worth printing. They do not wish to prevent so many copyists, to the number of 86,000 when I was at Constantinople, from earning a living, and it is this that the Turks have said themselves to Christians and to Jews who wish to introduce printing to the empire to make a profit. So there was simply too much of a vested interest. And to give a modern day example of what this could look like, I lived in Istanbul for a number of years. Uber has tried to break into Istanbul, but there are so many taxi drivers in the city and they charge cheaply and you really wouldn't save any money with Uber that people don't bother taking Uber, even though it's cool and more technologically advanced than taxis. It doesn't meet any need that's already being met, so they're not making any inroads there because the traditional industry is doing it just fine. So we could say that traditional copying and handwriting was meeting the need of readable materials just fine in Istanbul. Now let's look at these sultanic edicts themselves and see what was actually going on here. Murad III, a sultan from 1574 to 1599, issued the first firman concerning print in 1588. It survives at the back of an Arabic edition of Euclid's Elements that was published by the Medici Oriental Press in Rome. The firman asserted the rights of two European merchants to their trade of valuable printed books and pamphlets in Arabic within the empire. It ordered that the traders were to henceforth be left unbothered or unmolested by those who are opening up their shipments by force and with little or no payment at all are taking their wares and interfering with trade. Here's what the decree actually says. Be it hereby known to all governors, sea captains, judges, and other officials stationed in the imperial domain, the two European merchants by the names of Anton and Horatio Bondini, being bearers of imperial permission to conduct trade, are buying and selling and doing business by importing certain goods and valuable printed books and pamphlets in Arabic, Persian, and Turkish. Some persons are opening up their shipments by force, and with little or no payment at all, are taking their wares and interfering with their trade. It is therefore directed that the said merchants and their agents and employees be allowed to carry on their business in safety, and that their merchandise be not seized, and that whosoever disobeys this decree of mine be reported immediately. It is also ordered that their books and goods be purchased in return for the payment of the correct price. There should be no longer any complaints in this matter. This is written in Constantinople in that year. If we jump forward a few centuries to the reign of Ahmed III in the early 1700s, he also writes a firman about Ibrahim Mutafari Kah and his printing press. Now, I'm not going to read this whole statement. It's very, very long. He starts off talking about the importance of education and learning for the elucidation of minds. And we'll get into the meat of it now about the Sultan allowing the printing press during the time of Ibrahim Mutafari Kah and why he allows it. He writes, among the technical processes, printing is like coining money and impressing paper with a signet ring. Books produced by printing cause several thousand volumes to be produced from a single volume, all of which are accurate copies. With little effort, there is great return, making this a desirable activity to pursue. By virtue of your having composed a learned tract about, and having expertise in, the various above-mentioned activities, and he's talking about Ibrahim Mutafari Kah and his abilities as a printer, you will see to the necessities and expenditures without loss of time, so that on a fortunate day, this Western technique will be unveiled like a bride and will not again be hidden. It will be a reason for Muslims to say prayers for you and praise to you to the end of time. Accepting books of religious law, Quranic exegesis, the traditions of the Prophet, and theology, you ask the Padishah's permission in the aforementioned tract to print dictionaries, history books, medical books, astronomy and geography books, travelogues, and books about logic. So the printing of religious books are not allowed, and they don't really come about until the 1800s. That's when the Ottoman Empire is feeling pressure from other Muslim empires and figures. Well, if these holy books are going to be printed, then we might as well be the ones to do it. Anyway, I don't want to get off track, so I'm going to jump back to the Sultan's statement again. The imperial permission becomes proper on account of this well-explained authoritative declaration, this perfectly eloquent and noble opinion. Copies will be printed of dictionaries and books about logic, astronomy, and similar subjects, so that the printed books will be free from printing mistakes. The wise, respected, and meritorious religious scholar specializing in law, and then he mentions a bunch of scholars here, and he mentions scholars that will oversee the proofreading. With the actual setting up of the press, the above-mentioned books in history, astronomy, geography, logic, and so forth, after they pass the review of the learned scholars, shall be numerous. However, you will take special care to see that the copies remain free from error and depend on the noble learned men for this. So, what do we make of all this? We don't have copies of the firmans of Bayazid from 1493 and Selim from 1515 that were claimed to outlaw any sort of printing. We don't have any proof that these exist. We just have the opinion of this Franciscan scholar that they did exist, and we don't have any evidence that they exist. We have a statement from Thevet in 1584 that such a ban was brought in, but he might not be reliable. And we have these later statements in the late 1500s that foreign merchants can sell printed books. And we have a statement by Marsigli in the 1680s that no legal ban existed on printing books, but there were so many copyists around that there wasn't much of an interest in them. And we have a firman by Ahmed in 1727 that says printing is allowed and it's good for society. So as far as we can tell, There's not a problem with printing, but there just wasn't a social need for it. This comes back to the social construction of technology I was talking about earlier. Society didn't deem it as useful as it did in the West because the West didn't have this huge industry of calligraphers and copyists, and there wasn't the same religious prohibition on books in Europe as there was in the Middle East because there wasn't the same tradition of calligraphy attached to the Bible as there was to the Quran in the Middle East. Now, in the early years of printing in Europe and the Ottoman Empire, if you wanted to buy a book, for the most part, if you were going to buy a book, it was going to be a holy book. If you were a Christian in Europe, you would probably buy a Bible before you would buy anything else. Even if you wouldn't read it yourself, you would want to show it off to others to show your wealth. If you were a pious Muslim and owned a book, one of the earliest would be a glorious handwritten copy of the Quran. This would be an item that you would prize, you would show it off to others if you were wealthy, and if you were authentically religiously pious, that would be another reason to purchase it as well. But if you could only really afford a few books, and in Europe it was the Bible, this could spur on the nascent printing industry. But in the Middle East, if it was the Quran, this wouldn't spur on the printing industry. You would be purchasing books on logic and astronomy. That wouldn't be the first book that someone would own. That would be, I don't know, the fifth or the tenth book that someone would own. So the economic stimulus to the printing industry didn't really come to the Ottoman Empire until much later. Now let's jump ahead and look at when the printing industry actually does take off and when the social conditions change that allow for this industry to spring forward. Things change in the Ottoman Empire, and not just the Ottoman Empire, but for Muslim intellectuals across the world, in India, Russia, Egypt, and other places in the 1800s. This is where you have a what some scholars call a republic of letters. It's this print sphere where people are reading each other and writing to each other. They're reading each other's newspapers. They're commenting on it. And it's this connection with people that crosses borders. And this spreads across the world in the 1800s in the Muslim world. The explosion of this print culture happens from about the 1860s onward. The center of Ottoman publishing activity is in Istanbul, which is the location of the majority of Turkish language printing presses. It happened following the inauguration of the 1839 Tanzimat reforms. The Tanzimat was a period of reform in the Ottoman Empire from 1839 to 1876. With this, there was a far-reaching need for book production, which came about in response to the growing number of primary and secondary schools in the empire. Many private printing presses opened during this time, and the print culture continues to expand in the end of the 19th century, with a flourishing of printing presses, not just in Turkish, but also in Arabic, Persian, Greek, French, English, Armeno-Turkish, which is the Turkish language but written with Armenian letters, and books in Karamanla, which is newspapers and books in the Turkish language, but with Greek characters. But ironically, one of the things that spurred on the advancement of printing in the Ottoman Empire was the arrival and presence of foreign Protestant missionaries who came to the Ottoman Empire to try to convert people to Christianity, specifically Protestant Christianity. And they weren't just doing this among Muslims. They were doing this actually mostly among Catholic and Orthodox Christians that lived in the Ottoman Empire who were from Armenian background or Greek background or Syrian background. But anyway, when they came, they set up print shops and they had an enormous influence on the Ottoman Empire. By the early 19th century, foreign missionaries established a publishing infrastructure in the Ottoman Empire that produced thousands of books a year in multiple languages. One group, the American Board, which were a Congregationalist missionary organization, set up printing operations in Malta in 1822, and this Mediterranean island was chosen as the center of their print operations for the Middle East missions to Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Greece, and Turkey. The Malta operation consisted of three presses with font types in English, Italian, Greek, Armenian, and Arabic. One of their first books was a copy of the New Testament, 1831, in Armeno-Turkish. The same year, 78,000 copies of 14 works, totaling 5 million pages, were printed in modern Greek. So the total print output in Malta from 1822 to 1833 was 350,000 volumes. Part of the reason that missionaries were able to do so much is because print technology allowed it to become easier to transport printing presses from Europe to the Middle East. Lord Stanhope's development of a freestanding and portable iron hand press in 1800 enabled printing units to be set in one portable piece, and they didn't have to be disassembled and reassembled upon arrival to its destination, which enabled faster technological spread of printing. And the Muslim development of printing came from the successes of portable presses, as they didn't have to be joined to a larger industrial infrastructure. So Egypt and Istanbul didn't have to catch up to Europe in order to produce a productive print sphere. So with the spread of printing presses, with the need for more of them, with government reforms, they spread to Ottoman provinces. Turkish printing presses were established in Ottoman provinces in Anatolia. They typically produce the province gazette, the official newspaper, and they also produce Ottoman government yearbooks, which government officials use to spread official state news to the provinces. Publishers also use these government presses to print private books. So you have official imperial print offices being established in the 1860s and 1870s to produce religious texts, public documents, border protocols, international agreements, directories, dictionaries, educational textbooks, and works by Ottoman literary figures. And with the spread of newspapers and books, this changes the way that literary figures write. They're using a simplified style of Turkish in their newspaper articles in order to make their writings accessible to non-scholars. In earlier generations, the writing would be very dense, very purple prosy, because only those who would be wealthy and highly educated would have access to written materials. So this vibrant reading culture had major influence due to its social criticism, instruction, editorials, and reporting of foreign news. Rising rates of literacy in the 1890s, brought about by government educational efforts, expanded the reading landscape outside of elite circles. There's a transformation of society and the formation of an educated middle class that really asserts itself with the formation of the independent Turkish Republic in the 1920s. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. So this vibrant public sphere made the modernization and nationalization efforts of the Turkish Republic possible by increasing both literacy rates and access to books. So all that to say, the whole issue of printing presses that I was dealing with at the top of this episode, why do they show up in Europe so early but don't show up in the Ottoman Empire until much later, I think has to do with this issue of the social construction of technology. So human action shapes technology. A society determines if a technology is useful, and the Ottoman Empire simply didn't deem a printing press useful, like much of Europe did, until much later when there was a much bigger need for books and the industry and the number of people who were involved in calligraphy couldn't keep up with demand. But for centuries they could, so that's why you don't see as many printing presses. Anyway, I hope this episode was enjoyable, and I'd like to thank Firas for asking me the question. All right, well, that is the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, Moon Doggy from Ohio, Vic and Irene, and Rick Knowlton, and I'll explain what that means in a second. If you like the show, please leave a rating or review on the podcast listener of your choice, whether it's iTunes, whether it's Stitcher, Google Podcasts, whatever. Also, we have a Facebook page. You can join us there to keep up the discussion on latest episodes. And finally, if you really want to dig in deeper with this show, I encourage you to join the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, You get all the same stuff as the scouts and intelligence officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.